Hello and welcome to Big Nerdy Questions. We are back with Josh P.
Hello, and let me just say, it is an honor to be a part of the first episode of B&Q with theme music.
Yes, and I should say, big B&Q props to the composer of that music, Kevin MacLeod. This song is called Adventure Meme on SoundCloud, and the link to it will be in the show notes. So, thank you for Adventure Meme. That is our new theme song. Let us know if you like it or you hate it. Either way, we're okay to hear it. We're big boys and girls. We can handle it. So, tonight, we are at B&Q Episode 7. What is the best Star Trek movie? Part 2. Last week, we only got through the first 6 movies. As a reminder, we're not including Star Trek Beyond in our discussion. It's too new to really have a historical significance yet. We'll revisit the topic later, I'm sure. We are not avoiding spoilers, so if you haven't seen the 6 most recent films except Beyond, stop now or forever hold your peace. And at the end of the episode tonight, we will be giving a gold, a silver, and a bronze to our favorite 3 Star Trek movies. That said, we do have some B&Q news. 2 quick things. If you haven't heard yet, we are now available on iTunes. You may be listening to it from your iOS or your iTunes, but previously we were just on Podbean. We're still using Podbean as our main home, but we are now also available on iTunes. Search B&Q, Big Nerdy Questions, to find us in the iTunes store under podcasts. We're super excited about that, and we hope you are too. Also, we have to thank the Twitter X-Men TAS, that's the Twitter account of 2 of the creators of the X-Men original animated series of the 1990s, the best animated series for the X-Men ever, in my opinion. They tweeted out a link to our 2nd episode on which X-Men mutation would most ruin your life, and they said they enjoyed the show. So thank you so much, guys. We really appreciate it, and we hope that we can continue to entertain you with other various topics. Any thoughts, Josh?
Did they answer the question? Did they give their opinion on what they thought was the worst mutation?
You know, they have not answered explicitly yet. We've had other people answer. Fabian, who said that he thought the worst were Nightcrawler for physicality and Professor X for mental stress. But they have not answered, so hopefully we can get their answer in an upcoming episode. I'll try to see if they'll answer the question. Maybe they don't want to slight any of their own characters. We'll have to see.
That's true. You gotta love all your babies equal, I guess.
Yes, unless you're a parent of Jar Jar Binks. Which I also, that's one other thing I should point out in terms of news. If you've listened to our Star Trek or Star Wars prequels episode, you know that Matt, our beloved Matt, who will be with us on our next episode, he posited the theory that Jar Jar Binks was supposed to be a Sith Lord, and that would have made the prequels significantly better. It's a theory that's been going on in Reddit for a couple of years, and he subscribes to the theory. Well, this week, one of the writers of Episode 8 tweeted out a picture of Jar Jar wearing a Sith robe with the hashtag, many people are saying. Who knows what that means? It could just be a joke, but we finally have a recognition from someone in the Star Wars universe who actually has power over the franchise, recognizing the Jar Jar Sith, the Sith Binks meme. So congratulations to Matt. He may have started a major trend.
I think that's the effect of the B&Q bump, as we're going to start calling it.
Exactly. Sure. The B&Q bump, bigger than either convention, but less balloons. We have enough hot air already as is.
You're on fire, Josh. Keep them going.
All right. Well, one more thing we need to do tonight. We need to do our big nerdy recommendation. I am going to recommend a classic of science fiction called Something Wicked This Way Comes. It's a novel, more like a short story, but it's, you know, between short story and novel, by Ray Bradbury, classic science fiction author. It is a tale of what happens when a carnival comes to town in the 50s and 2 kids explore it, but that carnival is a lot more than meets the eye. There is evil afoot in the carnival. Something wicked is truly coming in this classic tale. If you've liked Ray Bradbury's other works, track this one down. It is something of a forgotten gem, but it is a great story. Something Wicked This Way Comes from Ray Bradbury. Since I had such a good science fiction author to start us off, it is only natural to now get into our discussion of the Star Trek films. And we're going to start off with Star Trek Generations, which has the crossover with Kirk and Picard. A personal story for this one to open up. Growing up, I was a huge Next Generation fan, and I only knew the original series really from the movies, but I never had a chance to see one of them in the theaters in the initial run. I was too young for Undiscovered Country. Generations was the first Star Trek film I saw in the cinema. I was actually checked out of school early the day it came out, and we saw the very first showing at 12:30 of Star Trek Generations. And when I saw it as, you know, a kid, I was enthralled with it because it was so cool to see my favorite characters on the screen, to see Data finally have emotions, to see my favorite ship ever, the Enterprise D, finally get its due, although it does meet its maker by the end of the movie. At first, I had a very positive opinion of this movie. As time went on, I think my opinion on it has tempered a little bit. I don't think it's a bad movie, but it's certainly not deserving of blanket praise anymore. What are your thoughts on Generations, Josh?
I think it's a bad movie. That's mean. I agree. It is definitely not deserving of praise and regard as one of the better movies of the Star Trek franchise. So many things that I just did not like. I did not like the terrible way in which Captain Kirk allegedly dies in the beginning of the movie. And then I didn't like how they brought him back out of the Nexus in the end for 5 minutes, and then he dies a really horrible death again.
He took a bridge too far.
Yeah, that's one way of putting it.
I completely agree, and I mean, this is the elephant in the room with this movie. Kirk's death, while Kirk, I have no issue, narratively speaking, with Kirk dying in this movie, but how they did it is horrible. And I think neither death works. I think the first death on the Enterprise B may have worked a little bit better if it sticks, because at least he has a purpose. But the second death, he really isn't even doing anything to take out Soren. That's still Picard. And yes, Kirk is obviously not in his physical prime anymore. He's not going to be doing his Kirk judo chop anymore. But let's go back to the original series in Arena, where he fought the Gorn. He did not defeat the Gorn with his physical power. He used his brain to come up with interesting strategies to outthink the Gorn. And we're told that the Gorn is a very smart species, and this is a particularly smart military officer. He's got to be the same level of intelligence roughly as Soren. And Soren is not a military expert from what we're told. He's a scientist. He's an Elori. I mean, he's a mad scientist. He's evil, but he's not a military genius. He's not Khan or Chang or even the Borg Queen. I don't see how his tactics could have out-strategized the team of Captain Kirk and Captain Picard. But instead of strategizing, they just go balls to the wall and end up having Kirk dying under a bridge.
that's well put.
It's a horrible waste of what could have been the most important death in the history of the franchise.
I agree, and I gotta believe that there are people who are very huge fans of Kirk and his generation that were probably screaming, why did he die during the era of Next Generation? What's that all about? Why couldn't he have died in his own way back then?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like there could have been another way to handle it. I think Generations is the ultimate movie of what could have been. And there's a couple of ways that applies. In the initial script for Generations, it wasn't supposed to be Kirk, Chekhov, I want to say Scotty, yeah?
Scotty.
On the Enterprise B. It was supposed to be the Triumvirate, McCoy, Spock, and Kirk. Spock refused to come back because he said that he'd wrapped up the character in Unification. And so Leonard Nimoy refused to come back, more accurately. D. Kelly was in poor health, or he may have actually deceased. He may have actually passed away before the filming. So that is what happened there. So that takes away part of the story. And I don't think they wanted to come back to begin with because it would have been a bit part in a Kirk story. You also have the acknowledgement from the writers of Star Trek The Next Generation, particularly Rick Berman and Michael Piller. They both acknowledge that the script for All Good Things, which is the finale of Next Generation, is an infinitely better story than Generations. And even though they put more time into Generations, All Good Things is a better encapsulation of the spirit of Next Generation. It gives every character important moments because of the time travel structure. Q is a villain unique to TNG. Everything hit. And it's considered, I think, still to this day, one of the best series franchises, especially in science fiction. Generations does not have that sort of iconic level. And it's before the age where movies were doing things just for a money grab, but you have to feel like the inclusion of Kirk's crew was just for a money grab. It doesn't feel like there's any need creatively for Kirk's crew, or specifically Kirk, to be in this story.
No, it seems like a total afterthought. They just injected them in after they had written a complete movie.
And I think there's a lot more to explore. In my opinion, one of the most interesting moments in the whole movie is when Captain Picard is in the Nexus and you see what he thinks life would have been like with a family.
And yet, even though that's all he ever seemed to long for, because that's how the Nexus works, it still wasn't right. Because Jean-Luc Picard is a man of service.
I agree. And I think, so that's a bad construction of the Nexus. I think if they rephrase the Nexus as, what if your life went in a different direction as opposed to your life's biggest wishes, that may have been better. Because it is an interesting thing to consider what happens if Picard does have a family. Because of all the stories we've seen in the Next Gen where he's had to deal with the families on board the Enterprise. And they really should have played up the family theme better. Because you have a ship going down in the Enterprise D being destroyed with hundreds of kids on board. And they don't discuss that at all.
No, they only bring out the family aspect of the Enterprise D when it's convenient to the story. And to an extent, I would say they did that in most of the Next Generation series too. Not that I'm accusing, I'm saying it's a bad thing necessarily, but there are plenty of times when I'm watching Next Generation where I completely forget their families are on board with them.
Absolutely. I mean, there are some episodes where you have to wonder why anyone in their right mind would bring their family on board. Which is a point they make in DS9. They're like, why would you ever have family on board a ship? You know, maybe they realize the error of that thought.
Yeah, I agree.
So, last time we were doing pros and cons of each movie. So, do you have a particular pro or con of this movie in addition to what we've already said?
Pro, I'm going to say, as bad as it was, at least we knew how Captain Kirk met his end. And I want to say that that is also my biggest con. And that one thing that we didn't even mention about Kirk's death is that Kirk did not die alone.
No, he died with Captain Picard.
Right there, yep.
Yeah, so it's an interesting take on it. When we asked a few weeks ago if the Star Wars prequels were redeemable, do you think Generations could have been redeemed with some changes, or do you think the story is too convoluted to fix?
I think that it would take some real under-the-hood work on the story, but yeah, it's redeemable. I can see them wanting to explore this idea, but in my opinion, the writing and the execution were just not up just to the typical Star Trek standards.
I agree. And I should point out, while I enjoyed seeing the Enterprise D on screen, from a continuity perspective, some of the set changes without explanations are annoying. I understand they did some set dressing to the bridge to make it better for a movie set, but at least have a throwaway line in there about a refit, because it's right after All Good Things, so why is the bridge changed? Also, acknowledge the uniform changes. You start in the beginning of the movie, everyone is wearing the Next Gen standard duty uniform, and by the end, almost every character is wearing the jumpsuit from DS9. What the hell? I understand you want to establish that's the new standard uniform in the Trek universe, but then you might as well say in the beginning of the movie, you know, all these jumpsuits really aren't comfortable, or have some sort of throwaway line from a character like Geordi or Beverly to at least establish that they've gone to this uniform style rather than just introducing it haphazard, because I doubt very much a ship ran by Jean-Luc Picard would allow people to haphazardly choose which uniform they want to wear, unless you're Deanna Troi.
That's a good point, yes.
So it's a nitpicky thing, but it's still there. You know, one thing we have to talk about on this movie before we move on, What are your impressions of Data's emotion chip?
That emotion chip made Data the Jar Jar Binks of Star Trek. I'm so sorry to say that about my favorite character in Star Trek, but he became the most annoying person on the face of the earth with that chip. But still made you laugh when you saw it for the first time, just like Jar Jar admitted.
True enough. And I do have to give a point for acknowledging the joke they told in an encounter at Farpoint.
Yes.
That may be the smartest moment in the whole movie.
Sadly.
But it was still a nice callback to the very first episode of The Next Generation. But I think we're going to get into Data's emotions a little more in our next film. I don't think it's a spoiler to say that a lot of people consider this to be the masterpiece of the Next Gen films. Of course, I'm talking about Star Trek First Contact.
Yes.
Josh, what are your thoughts on this movie?
I really like Star Trek First Contact. I think they answer a lot of what ifs, which sometimes can be a bad thing when you have too many what ifs in one movie, but they put them together and wrote a movie around all of these what ifs that just turned out to be one of the greatest works in all of Star Trek. What if the crew went back in time and met the inventor of the warp drive?
As played by James Cromwell, in a magnificent casting choice.
Agreed.
Yeah, there's so many what ifs in this movie, and they're all answered well. So just for background, for people who aren't familiar with the narrative of how this film was made, they made the decision to do the next TNG movie. It would include time travel. And they were strongly considering the Borg in some way, shape, or form as another story. You know, yeah. So the initial script of this film was actually set, it was going to be called Star Trek Renaissance. And it was going to be set in the Renaissance, where Data's memory is wiped and he ends up becoming an apprentice for Leonardo da Vinci. And they actually reused da Vinci in Voyager as the holodeck guidance officer for Janeway. In Scorpion Parts 1 and 2 that introduced 7 of 9. So the idea was to bring the Enterprise crew back to the Renaissance and have some sort of interaction, kind of like in The Voyage Home, but showing that the Enterprise crew may have been responsible for protecting the beginning of the enlightenment of humanity, so to speak. I think that may have worked, but then they ultimately decided that they wanted to go back in time, but forward in our time, to a period talked about but not shown, and they decided to show the effects of World War III, and then they realized, wait a second, we can show the first warp flight and first contact. And that is a brilliant decision of storytelling. Yes.
Oh, my goodness. And another good what if. What if it turned out that the inventor of the warp core was actually just an alcoholic looking to make money to retire on?
It's a perfect story, and it really shows what happens when a person is thrust into a position of influence, because we know from mentions of Zefram Cochrane and actually meeting him in the original series that he is actually a character of principle, a character of vision.
Well, some of the wisest quotes ever uttered in Star Trek are quotes of him.
Exactly. He almost becomes the Confucius of the Federation, so to speak. But this film shows that he's not that way until First Contact thrusts him into that position where he has no choice. And it's almost a circular loop, because the Enterprise crew shows up and forces him into having First Contact, but First Contact is what creates the Federation, which creates the Enterprise, and thank you, time travel.
Let's just call that a plot hole, maybe a little bit.
Maybe a little bit, but I think it's one that we can excuse.
Well, certainly.
Because, I mean, the original narrative was established that he was going to fly the warp drive ship, the Phoenix, anyway. It just so happens the Enterprise E crew shows up to help him along. And the first white flight included Geordi and Riker, because why not? The other thing that's really interesting, in the initial script for this movie, originally it called for Riker to stay on the ship and Picard to be on Earth overseeing the Phoenix. And Jonathan Frakes, as the director, objected for two reasons. First of all, he said, in terms of storytelling, you need to establish the dynamic between Picard, the Borg Queen, and Data. And so that is on the storytelling point. Another thing he said accurately was Commander Riker would never let Captain Picard be on Earth with the Borg there for that long. He would be on the away mission on Earth while Picard stayed on board the Enterprise, as was the case almost always in TNG.
Yes.
So, do you think the film would have worked had they gone with the initial plan of Riker on board, Picard on the ground?
I'm going to start by saying absolutely not as good. Okay, now, that being said, is there enough good story left after you remove Picard from his own personal history with the Borg and from that decision whether or not to self-destruct the Enterprise? If you take away the greatest Captain Picard quote of all time, is there still enough story left there to make it a good movie? It's possible, because I'm sure he would have made up for it by making the Zefram Cochrane side of that entire movie even better. But I couldn't picture him getting into the Phoenix and listening to Magic Carpet Ride by Steppenwolf and being quiet about it.
I don't think so. I honestly don't. There are so many iconic moments in this movie. What's your favorite?
It chills every time I see it. The line is drawn here. This far, no further.
No! Smash!
Yes.
Yeah, that is a wonderful moment.
Oh my goodness.
Never before has Captain Picard been so much like Ahab. And they actually, another behind the scenes fact, I'm sorry listeners if I'm inundating you, but can you tell I'm a fan of this movie? And of, you know, initial script did not have any overt references to Moby Dick. And I believe Patrick Stewart was the one who told them they should go ahead and include it because he had played Ahab. But he also said there's no shame in having them quote classic literature. This is Captain Picard, and Lily, who's well-educated as well, they're smart people. They would be using something like Moby Dick to make their point. And I think it's one of those times when it's nice to be said overtly because it wakes Captain Picard up a little bit.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that's what turned that entire conversation around and gave him a cooler head again when he realized who he was turning into.
So a couple of things that I find iconic in this movie. The scene that causes me the most squeamishness in the whole franchise, maybe with the exception of the bug in Wrath of Khan, but the opening scene where you see Captain Picard's ear being almost punctured by the Borg during the assimilation process.
Yeah. Oh. As you guys heard last week, I was fresh out of LASIK surgery when I started binge-watching Star Trek films. So naturally, watching that did not do my eyes any favors either.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Fun fact, though, that is the last time that the TNG original uniform shows up in a feature film.
Well, yeah. I guess it was.
That is a scary moment. I find it interesting in this film, you know, all the quotes on Earth about legacy with Zefram Cochrane. I love that they went back to the Dixon Hill program on the holodeck. So perfect. What an amazing callback to season one of TNG. But, you know, it's always one of those things. Picard is so refined, and yet his favorite holodeck program is this pulpy detective story from the 1940s. Perfect. Absolutely perfect for this story. And it establishes in canon the Borg cannot adapt to bullets. And there's something so viscerally pleasing about seeing a Borg being shot with a Tommy gun.
Yes.
It's just like, that's beautiful.
But in my opinion, the best shot that was fired was the shot fired right after Commander Worf said, "Assimilate this."
I was going to say the best sequence in the movie is the scene on the deflector dish.
Oh yes, that whole scene was great.
The music. Oh my god, the music makes that scene so intense. It's like, just keeps building the suspense.
Oh,
the Borg are walking slow, menacingly slow. Okay.
And then the final leap, like, I've seen the movie a dozen times. I still hold my breath during that final leap across the dish.
Absolutely. And I'll make a strong statement here. In the rest of the movie with the Borg Queen, the Borg lose a little bit of their scariness because they're supposed to be a collective where it's the complete hive mind. But in that deflector dish scene, They act just like they did in Best of Both Worlds. And my God, it's scary. There's no Borg Queen there. They're acting like a Borg would have in TNG. And it's spot on perfect.
Yes.
So we can just talk about the Borg Queen for a minute. Fantastic performance, by the way. I mean, define the role. I don't know. Some people online argue the Borg Queen ruined the Borg. If not in First Contact, then especially in her overuse in Voyager. I can see that case because, like I just said, the Borg are supposed to be hive-minded. And clearly, with her being in place and retconning it to where she had Locutus by her side, the Borg are not of a hive mind. Truly, they do have a leader, or at least some form of queen. We don't really know everything about how they operate. I don't think it takes away from the Borg completely. I understand why they did it, because you have to have a character for Picard to play off of on the silver screen. At least that's the idea. And I also think the way that she tempts Data, particularly in the scene where she gives him a patch of real skin and flesh with goosebumps, is creepy as all hell. So good job on that point, but I don't know if it would have been better or worse removing that character. What are your thoughts?
Well, again, being a fan of Data, Data would have pretty much been written out of that movie if it wasn't for her.
Yeah, she was the narrative for him.
Yes, and there's the Nexus, which can give any living being anything that it wants, that they want in theory, but she kind of became Data's personal Nexus because she was able to give him everything that he wanted as well, and he was able to tempt him successfully, as we find out. So no, I absolutely think the movie would be worse without her.
I love the line when he was tempted. How long were you tempted for? And he gives us a really small time. Then he says, but for an android, sir, that's an eternity.
Classic Data.
Do you think this film and the use of Data redeems the emotion chip?
100% it does. The emotion chip was so much better. And I mean, even from Generations, it showed over the course of the Generations movie that Data was becoming slightly better as time progressed at controlling his emotions. But by First Contact, he had definitely mastered them. Or, well, seemingly mastered his emotions. And then to learn how to be... To learn a new emotion, which hadn't occurred to him in the past, which was temptation. Yeah, I think it absolutely redeemed the use of the emotion chip right there.
And the one last thing we have to talk about on this movie, and I know we've talked about it a lot, listeners, but it's so good. I love the decision to make the Vulcans the species of First Contact.
It had to be the Vulcans.
It had to be. I mean, they could have chosen something like the Andorians or something random, but they chose the Vulcans. It fits perfectly. But it essentially sets up the basic narrative of Enterprise, the whole series.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't have Enterprise without that decision.
It's true.
I mean, we can debate the merits of that show. We probably will at some point. But that was a fantastic narrative choice. And I love the he does the Vulcan salute, at least tries, Zefram Cochrane, James Cromwell does. And then he gives the Vulcan a handshake.
Absolutely. You have to share your human greeting with your new alien friend the same way he just did with you.
And the sight of a Vulcan being given a beer, or whiskey, I should say, and drinking and singing whoopie-doobie, whoopie-doobie. Perfect.
Also, let's not forget, Deanna Troi got hammered in the beginning of that movie.
There's real humor in this movie. Yeah. That's really there. It's not forced like the emotion chip. It's like Deanna Troi gets drunk and, you know, he tried some things, Will. And then Geordi talking to Zefram Cochrane. Why'd you have to go? I have to take a leak. Or something broken? Don't you guys pee in the 24th century? Oh, man. So
you seem to be leaking coolant at an alarming rate.
Oh, man. First Contact, amazing. But we have to move on, and we have to go to Insurrection. So notice that we don't have as much initially to say about Insurrection, at least in a gushing tone. We do have things to say about it, but it's not as outwardly positive at first. What are your first thoughts on Insurrection?
Good, not great. Is my overall on that. I liked the idea of broken the Prime Directive, and the species was not primitive compared to, you know, to the Federation.
Yeah, that was a nice little twist.
Yeah.
I when I saw this movie and I left the theater, I told my dad who I saw it with, I felt like I just watched a two-part episode of the series.
Yes, I didn't want to quite say that so early, but yeah, I feel the same way.
I mean, it's not bad, and if it were if it were an episode in the series, I think it would actually be quite good. And the budget clearly went into some filming in some beautiful locations. But I feel like it's not a big enough story for a movie.
No. And in fact, there are several points throughout that movie which would have been very good for that suspenseful tone followed by a commercial break, too. It's really a TV script all the way.
Yeah, like when the time stops with Picard and his love interest, and I'm blanking on her name and I apologize to our listeners. When time stops, that can be a commercial break. When you first see the holodeck ship in the lake, that's a commercial break.
Certainly.
I mean, there's a lot of them built in. And I think it was a trope of the series where, you know, it's not all that revolutionary of an idea for an admiral to be corrupt. We saw that in the Pegasus. We saw that under the influence a little bit in the conspiracy in season one. We've seen some questionable decisions from Starfleet Command. I don't think it's fair the way the movie treated it, like it was the first time these officers have ever had to disobey an order from Starfleet. It's actually kind of a continuation of some of the things in the series.
I agree.
A couple of notes on this movie. It's the first time we see the white dress uniform variant of the uniform. Which, by the way, I should say that the uniform introduced in First Contact, if I wasn't going to say the red uniform from Wrath of Khan is my favorite, my second favorite uniform in the entire franchise is the gray uniform introduced in First Contact. It is super snazzy.
Oh, yeah.
I love that uniform. And when I play Star Trek Online, I actually use a variant of that uniform. I'm an admiral on Star Trek Online now, but I actually changed the top from black to white as an admiral, and then I kept the blue or the red in the collar. But otherwise, I kept it exactly like it was because it's a damn good uniform. So you see the white formal uniform for the first time. The visual of Picard with the head thing, the head necklace on, is really funny. But it's one of those moments that would be funny in the series too. It's not literally a cinematic kind of thing.
Yeah.
Really, a lot of the most interesting things in this movie are the small character moments. Like, I love, my favorite character growing up was always Geordi. So seeing him being able to see something with his own eyes was the most emotional moment of the whole movie for me.
Oh, yeah.
Even more so than Kirk and Riker, Kirk 2.0. Riker and Troy getting back together. It's a great moment, but Geordi's seeing, amazing.
Yes, I agree. Although I have to say, you know, he alluded to the fact that he might or might not lose his sight. And then, you know, you learn pretty quickly in the beginning of the next film that he did. I would have liked to have, you know, seen that decline at the end of Insurrection or heard them talk about that at the beginning of Nemesis.
I agree completely. And when we get to Nemesis in a second, I think that they shortchanged a lot of the characters in Nemesis. But in Insurrection, I think your synopsis is perfect. It's good, but not great. I like the idea of Worf shooting down the little drone things and then hitting them so down violently with his gun. That's perfect Worf visual. Although, why the hell is Worf there? There's no explanation for how he ended up on the Enterprise again. Because it's during DS9 and he should be on board the Defiant fighting the Dominion War, but what do I know? there's no explanation. It's just, okay, Worf's back on the Enterprise. Ta-da!
Yay!
Hooray! Yeah, it's good, but not great. Is there any other things that stand out in Insurrection in your mind?
Anything that stands out? Well, there's a Fountain of Youth in Insurrection. That's pretty cool.
It is. And you know, maybe for me, the only other thing that stands out for me is the fact that our major villain, the reason they're villainous is because they love plastic surgery. I mean, maybe they wanted to do a crossover with Nip Tuck. I'm not sure, but that was Okay.
I will give it credit, though. That was another one that I had seen for the first time when I started watching these movies for this episode of B&Q. And I legitimately did not see it coming that those creatures, those beings were actually the outcasts of the society that was living down on that planet.
I mean, that's a really clever twist, and I think it's a clever resolution of a TV episode.
Yeah, 100%.
I mean, it really is. So not a bad story. I think it's probably a better story cohesive-wise than Generations, but it's just not big. Moving on to Tom Hardy's breakout role, maybe? As Shinzon the Reeman with some steaming. I don't know. Sorry, reject that. But you got Shinzon, and he's Picard's nemesis. Haha. Because he is Picard, maybe. He's a genetic clone of Jean-Luc Picard, which it seems like a really forced way to create a personal story. When you think of nemesis, what do you think of, Josh?
2 hours of my life, I won't know. When I think of Nemesis, I actually think it's the second best of the Next Generation ones. When I think of it, I think of another good what if. What if Captain Picard, who has bested every enemy he's had so far, finally gets faced with having to defeat himself? I mean, himself is the only one left.
Yeah, that's a really interesting take on it. And I do enjoy the what if with Captain Picard. And it's actually one of my favorite scenes in the movie is when Picard and Shinzon have that dinner conversation about how Picard's life would have been different had he been raised in the Reeman Mines. And Picard says that Shinzon's life would have been different had he been raised by a family in a French vineyard. So it goes to the nature and nurture question in a similar way to Tapestry during the series, and I appreciate that. But I think some of the other threads in the movie are not very cohesive. You know, in my view, there are three distinct plots in the movie that could be a main storyline of a feature film for TNG. The Romulans want peace, Picard is faced with his clone, and Data finds a new brother.
Yes.
All three of those, in my opinion, could have been the basis of a movie on their own. I don't think you need to smash all three together.
No. I think they may have been trying to chase the success that came from First Contact, and they just came up with something not quite as good.
Yeah, I think you're right on that point. You know, you give Picard a personal villain, and I'm okay with this, but it's almost a mesh of the idea of Wrath of Khan with a mesh of The Undiscovered Country, in that you have one of the big bads of TNG wanting peace.
Yes.
Yeah, it doesn't work that well, though. And the inclusion of B4 is very much an attack on. It's a plot device for Shinzon to use, yes, but I really think it's included in the movie so that Data's death could have been written out if they did another TNG movie, much in the same vein as Search for Spock, because they have B4 whistle that song at the end to indicate that he has finally started to learn a little bit of what Data was able to be.
Yeah, okay. That's an interesting take. First off, talking about Data, his death was probably the only time I ever cried watching Star Trek.
Fair enough. It's a tough scene to watch.
Yeah, that was far tougher than Wrath of Khan's ending.
Well, to be fair, I think both of us are more personally attached to Next Gen anyway.
I agree.
So seeing Data go is rough.
Yes.
And Brent Spiner said that he actually co-wrote this movie, and he made the decision to kill off Data because he felt that as he aged, he could no longer play the part accurately because Data can't age.
That's a valid point.
From a creative standpoint, it makes sense. But why include B4 with that possibility of bringing Data back, giving him Data's memories? I feel like they could have come up with another way to have Data's legacy live on. maybe put his memories, integrate them into the Enterprise computer core, something.
Yeah.
That doesn't have the get out of jail free card element attached to it. They don't end up using it, but that's just because Nemesis was a financial failure and they scrapped the franchise.
Yeah, that was unfortunate. But I think a possible reason why they gave Data the possibility to live on even after killing him for that reason was because, in fact, the Star Trek franchise did continue to live on in print chronologically after Nemesis came out.
Yes, and if I remember correctly, isn't there one of the novel series where Data actually becomes captain of the Enterprise when Picard retires?
I have not read much of it, but I do know that Data is alive and well during most of that.
Yeah, so there's a point to be made right there. A couple notes on Nemesis. We have the appearance of Wheaton for the first time in the next-gen movies. I feel like Wesley Crusher could have used something more than a cameo, especially because Picard, the closest thing Captain Picard ever has to a child is Wesley.
Yes.
And I think you could have had, apparently they had a scene that was deleted, but I really wanted to see a conversation once Picard meets Shinzon between Picard and Wesley, because I think that would have been really interesting to see those two characters interact on that question. And it's a shame they did not go that route, in my book.
I agree.
But I was glad to see him on the screen. And if I remember correctly, we have Guinan in a cameo as well for the first time since Generations.
Yes.
Which was very nice to see. It's nice to acknowledge her importance to the crew. You know, Captain Picard's true confidant. Very happy to see Whoopi Goldberg. Although I'm fairly confident it was an uncredited role. I don't think she was in the closing credits of the film. So
I wouldn't know.
Interesting note. And of course, we have the marriage of Mr. and Mrs. Troy, which is a wrapping up of a storyline that took us the entire length of the series. So that was nice to see. And honestly, it was probably the only valid ending to that romance. Even though Troy and Worf showed some spark in season 7, I think most everyone thought Endgame was Troy and Riker, so it was nice to see it finally happen.
It had to be that way.
It had to be them. No. Sorry, listeners, you can put back your hearing aids now, because I'm sorry for the singing. But yeah, I think Nemesis is another one of those movies that could have been a lot better than it was. I think I don't like it as much as Insurrection. I think Insurrection's a better story, even though it's not as big. I think Nemesis is too convoluted. But I think it's a good movie. I just think, much like a lot of the next-gen movies so far, all of them, except for First Contact, there is a sense that there is an amazing movie there with a few edits here and there, with some story changes. It could have been amazingly well done. But as it is, it's only good.
Yeah.
So Nemesis, for whatever reason, was a financial flop. I'm not sure exactly why, but that's more for financial experts and movie experts than for us. So Star Trek went dormant on the screen for quite a while until J.J. Abrams took the mantle back and remade Star Trek and brought back Kirk and Spock and McCoy and the rest of the original crew in the 2009 Star Trek movie that's just called Star Trek, because we can't have subtitles anymore because colons are bad. This is probably the most polarizing Star Trek movie of the bunch because of what it does to the universe. For those of you who are a little unfamiliar, and I'm not going to get into the specifics here because it's too convoluted, due to what happens in the film at the beginning, you have the creation of a split timeline called the Kelvin timeline from the ship that was destroyed with Captain Kirk's father and mother on board. And, of course, Mrs. Kirk gives birth to James T. Kirk as it's happening. With the creation of the alternate timeline, all that we knew and loved from the original series, TNG, DS9, and Voyager, is in a different universe called the Prime Universe. And J.J. Abrams' universe continues on its own in a separate universe with no established rules and guidelines for what can happen. So they can revisit older stories, but in a different way. It's a smart way, in my opinion, to introduce the original crew while still having respect for Shatner, Nimoy, D. Kelly, and the rest of the original group. However, so my problem with this movie is not the creation of the alternate timeline. I think that's a fine science fiction trope that's perfectly legitimate in this movie.
Certainly, certainly.
My problem with this movie is that I don't think it's a Star Trek movie. I think it's a fantastic action science fiction movie, but it is not, in my opinion, Star Trek. It replaces philosophy with action. It replaces camaraderie with lens flares. And while it's a good movie, I'm not going to say it's bad. It's well made. It's an interesting story. The action is amazingly thrilling.
Yes.
It's just not Trek. It is Star Wars on the Enterprise. And there's no accident why J.J. Abrams directed Star Wars Episode 7. He did a trial run 4 years earlier.
You're not kidding, man. So I agree with that completely. It is not Star Trek. Not the Star Trek that I loved growing up. So that's why you have the lifelong Star Trek fans saying, this is not that good. But then you have the younger fans, the millennials, for lack of a better term, that watch this movie having not seen much of any Star Trek before. They just, you know, see a really big blockbuster movie with lots of explosions and, you know, attractive characters, and they go to the movie and think, oh my goodness, this is one of the greatest movies I've ever seen. And I get that. If you don't know much about Star Trek, you will love what they've done in these new movies.
And I don't begrudge them for making it accessible. It's really, it's accessibility is probably the movie's strongest suit.
Yes, it is, 100%. But so many things that, as a Star Trek fan, I look at and go, where's the part where they talk it out first? Where's the wisdom of the captain, or, you know, the wisdom of Spock? It's not there. The first movie is the struggle for power between Kirk and Spock the whole way. They hate each other, and you don't ever have that time for Spock to be the figure of wisdom that he is. But it's also quite possible just because they're all still young. I don't know. I didn't love that movie that much.
You know, I think on its own merits, it's a fine film that just doesn't fit what we want a Trek movie to be. And as an aside, what worries me about the direction of the film franchise, and we're not going to talk about Beyond specifically, but Beyond is included in this criticism. Chris Pine is actually, he was interviewed by a journalist who asked him about this complaint that Star Trek fans have been saying they want less action and more thought. More, and not necessarily just slow scenes. We had that with motion picture. That's not all we want. What we want is for the characters to act in a smart way, for them to contemplate what they're doing. Because to me, Star Wars is space checkers.
Yes. It,
Star Trek is space 3D chess. When Star Trek is written well, it is all about the intricacies of character and plot in a way that the characters all have their own agendas, but they're all doing it for the greater good of the Federation, at least in the Enterprise. It's an amazingly humanist perspective on reality. That was Roddenberry's vision. As a humanist, he wanted to show the best of humanity. And yes, there's action in Roddenberry's universe. And yes, in Roddenberry's vision, there was some sexism in the 60s. I'm sure we'll get to that eventually. But at its core, especially in Next Gen, the idea was to show what humanity could do if we all just got along with each other to fight for the common good. And there is none of that in the Abrams universe. It is completely chucked. The spirit of Trek is gone. And what's left is just the shell.
Yeah. It's so different. I don't like the change. Some people do. That's fine. We can get into an internet war on Twitter over this all day.
Oh, I'm sure that we will, but, you know, I stand by what I said.
Yeah, I stand with you, my friend.
And no offense to Star Wars, when I made my point, I love Star Wars too. But with Trek, I want something different, something distinctive.
Yeah.
And we didn't get that in this one. And I think we didn't get it in Into Darkness either. If anything, Star Trek 2009 is a good movie that's not a Trek movie. Into Darkness is a not good movie that's not a Trek movie.
Yeah.
I mean, there are some good parts to it. Cumberbatch is a great actor. He's miscast as Khan. That was a horrible decision. In my book, he should have been someone else. Maybe Gary Powers would have been better. Maybe there was some rumor that he was going to be Trelane from the original series. That would have been better. There were some rumors that he was going to be Q or AQ. That would have been better. That would have loved to see Cumberbatch as a Q. But no.
Cumberbatch as a Q, yes.
You make him Khan. What the hell are you thinking? That is the worst possible role for Cumberbatch. And he's a great actor, but they wrote it horribly. The problem with Khan. Here's the problem with Khan. You've completely changed who he is, but oh wait, the Abrams split off in the timeline shouldn't have mattered for Khan. Because Khan was sent out into space in the space seed in the original Star Trek series in 1997. Long before the Abrams universe splits off. So Khan should have been exactly the same character as in Wrath of Khan, based on the canon established in the original series of what established with Khan. And if you make him a totally different character, if you change his freaking ethnicity, you have broken your own rules.
Yeah, that's another thing I hadn't thought of. I didn't really put much thought past just how bad of a con Benedict Cumberbatch is. The one thing I have to say that putting Benedict in that role has going for him is that they definitely did make Khan a tall, imposing figure.
Yeah, that's the only good thing they've got going for
him. Oh, yeah.
And, you know, we talked about Into Darkness a little bit during our last discussion of Wrath of Khan, because this is essentially a remake of Wrath of Khan with a few things through a lens darkly, to use the Mirror Universe phrase. You've got Kirk dying instead of Spock, but oh wait, he gets resurrected in the same movie because no one has patience anymore. You've got Spock and Khan having a fist fight because Vulcans, that's what they do, and not go for the nerve pinch or a phaser, because that's logical. What the hell? You've got Khan's crew inside torpedoes? Really? Because the augments suddenly have the ability to power weapons when they're unconscious in a metal tube? Give me a break. I mean, there are so many things that are wrong in this story. And yet, when watching it, it's not a bad popcorn movie. You know, you watch it and you kind of get lost in it. And oh, look, there's Mickey from Doctor Who. And oh, look, there's Sherlock. And oh, look, there's our crew again. And the Enterprise looks pretty. But it's not Star Trek, and it completely breaks every rule of what they established in the 09 movie.
It's okay, Josh. You don't have to hold back anymore. You can tell us how you really feel.
Whew!
I can't follow that, man. I can't follow that.
I'm just saying, it is what it is, and coming from a lifelong Trekker who lives and breathes this franchise, God. I
want you
wish.
To seriously consider editing in an explosion sound at the end of that speech.
I'm sure I can find one from Star Trek Into Darkness.
Yeah, take your pick.
I mean, good God, if I could do a lens flare through audio, I would.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so on that note, Bruce Faber. Hello, listeners. I apologize for that rant, but I just showed you more character depth than the entire Into Darkness film.
Heyo!
So, I think it's time to give our gold, silver, and bronze. So I think we'll just go through real quick and say what our bronze is, what our silver, and what our gold is. What's your bronze, Josh?
I initially was going to go with a Next Generation film. But after we talked last week about Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, and after I talked with some other people in between last week's episode and this week's episode, I learned a lot more about why that is a good story for the original series crew to have been on. I never knew much about them. I've probably seen less than 15% of the original series episodes. And when I learned that it's totally okay for them to do a comedy like that, because you would never see that in Next Generation, it became a lot more okay. And because I really enjoyed the movie, and I thought that they showed a lot of what the real world is like in that Star Trek universe, I'm going to have to say that Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, gets my bronze.
Well, with the nuclear vessels, it almost has to.
Oh, yeah. All kinds
Star Trek IV is my fourth place movie. It just finishes behind in the medal count. I'm really sad. I love the movie, but I'm going to give my bronze to The Undiscovered Country. I think that Star Trek VI is the perfect send-off for the original crew, not counting Generations. The visuals in that film are arresting. The music is perfect. Nicholas Meyer directing coming back is great. The political intrigue is well done. Chang is one of the best villains in the entire franchise, extremely underrated as the Shakespearean Klingon. The assassination of Chancellor Gorkon is one of the most memorable scenes in the entire franchise. Yeah, I love Star Trek VI, so I'm giving that my bronze.
All right, sounds good, man. So on to my silver. My silver is 100% Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan.
That is an interesting choice for silver. My silver is probably going to be your gold, and I think vice versa. My silver by a hair is First Contact, because it's my favorite next-gen movie, and next-gen's my favorite series, so it's going to be high up there. I love the integration of the Borg with one of the most important historical events in the entire Trek franchise. I can't find a single fault with that film that breaks it. It's a fantastic piece of work, and that's why I give it the silver. But I respect Wrath of Khan as a silver. That's a solid choice, too.
Gold, for me, it should come as no surprise, considering how I didn't stop gushing over it the entire time. Absolutely First Contact. Then none of the others are even close.
That's a great choice, and I think you know my gold is Wrath of Khan. You know, it's kind of obvious at this point, and it's by a hair, and honestly, that opinion changes every other year. Back and forth between those two. In my book, those two stand so far above the rest of the pack, it's not even funny.
Yeah.
Those two, if I was going to say, those two films, in my opinion, are not just good Trek films, they're just good science fiction classics, period. They're amazing movies. They deserve all of our praise. You know, all hail the filmmakers of that movie. Jonathan Frakes is a very underrated director. Is that what a fantastic job on First Contact? We already know that Wrath of Khan is amazing. And I should point out, the director of Wrath of Khan, Nicholas Meyer, is coming back as a consultant at the very least on Star Trek Discovery, the new series that debuts on CBS All Access Digital in the spring. So for us real Trekkies, and that series, by the way, it was announced as of recording, it's going to be set right before Kirk's time period, but still in that general time period. It's going to have a female lead. It's going to have an LGBT character. It's going to introduce a lot of new aliens, but still show aliens that we know and love in the franchise. It sounds like it's going to be a fantastic series. I'm hopeful. I am optimistic at this point. And I've heard a rumor, I don't know if it's true, but I've heard the rumors, because I said today that the female lead will not be a captain. I've heard a rumor that this series is actually going to be about the beginnings of Section 31. And if that is true, and for those of you who don't know, who didn't watch DS9, Section 31 is essentially the covert ops of the Federation that operates independently of Starfleet and the Federation. It can get dark very quickly. Some of the best episodes of DS9. If that's true, we're in for a great ride.
I think so. I haven't heard nearly as much about it as you have, and actually just hearing what you said makes me feel a lot better about this.
There is hope, really, and I hope that it will be good. The Abrams Star Treks are not bad, but they're not Treks, as I just went into quite a discussion. So, ladies and gentlemen, our gold and silver are Wrath of Khan and Undiscovered Country, Wrath of Khan and First Contact. But we disagree on gold and silver. We disagree on which film is bronze between Voyage Home and Undiscovered Country. Although I think we both agree those two are really good too. If there were four places, we probably would agree on top four.
Certainly, yes.
So
absolutely put it six on my four.
I want you guys and who are listening to this episode to let us know. I know we're gonna have some strong defenders of Abrams Trek. I know we're gonna have some people who do not like First Contact for whatever reason, or think Wrath of Khan is a, for lack of a better word, a tired pick as the favorite. There is a lot to pick apart here. and I know us Trekkies have strong opinions on it. I clearly do. So please let us know your thoughts. Send us an email at bignerdyquestion@gmail.com or at bnqfeedback@gmail.com. You can send us a text and we can read it out. You can also send us an audio clip as an MP3, and we can try to get it into the show if you really want to put that in there, because this is something that I really want us to talk about. You can also send us tweets at BNQ Podcast. We love seeing tweets from listeners. It keeps us going. It's like when Sonic the Hedgehog gets the air bubble. That's the same kind of feeling that we get when we get a tweet from a listener. So please send us in your feedback. I think that finally, after 2 hours and a few minutes, wraps up the Star Trek film discussion for now. But we do have one piece of business to take care of before we go. We have to kill the emotion chip Data of the Star Wars universe. We have to kill Jar Jar Binks. Josh, how are we killing Jar Jar tonight?
Well, before I get into that, I would just like to say, because we haven't had a hashtag all episode, I think Star Trek Jar Jar would be a good one, or Jar Jar Data, possibly.
Jar Jar Data is our official hashtag of the Star Trek movies episode. Well done.
All right. So this is going to either be the greatest Jar Jar death all season or the worst, but I just want to say, Matt, I'm sorry. I'm definitely taking away one of your two superlatives here. So here we go. Josh, count the movie references. After discovering his enemy to be a younger clone of himself, Jar Jar engages in an epic battle for control of the Fountain of Youth on a planet from which he had been outcast for attempting to overthrow the leader many years ago. Unfortunately, his ship was captured and his crew assimilated by the Borg en route, but thankfully he was able to escape in the only pod left untouched. After a few days drifting in space, he was sucked in by a large energy ribbon, but just as he was entering a world where everything he ever wanted was his, he was blown off course by the explosion of a large moon and crash-landed on a strange planet in the center of the galaxy. The benevolent godlike inhabitant of the planet transports him aboard the nearest nuclear vessel, the HMS Humpback, and he joins its crew on a mission to find one of their dead on a new planet that was popped out of nowhere. This vessel was attacked by a stolen Federation ship that then beamed Jar Jar on as a prisoner, but after being utterly annoyed by him, they decide to beam him down to a nearby uninhabited planet to exile him. However, Jar Jar's original crew comes to find him, and as they're beaming him up, he gets shot by the stolen Federation ship, causing a power surge in the transporter. And as they tried to pull him back out of transport, they were successful, but Jar Jar's matter was horrendously rearranged, and what they got back didn't live long, fortunately.
Well done.
Yes. For those of you keeping score at home, that was references to all 10 of the Star Trek movies in reverse order.
That was epic, sir. Jar Jar is completely dead, but B&Q will live on. For Josh P., this is Josh H., signing off this week. We'll see you again next time.